Hello and welcome to this month's CIO live stream, live here on our website and on LinkedIn. I'm Kiran Ganesh, Global Head of Investment Communications here in the UBS Global Chief Investment Office. Now, I'm sure you all remember just a couple of years ago when central banks were busy hiking interest rates to try and combat inflation, we were all debating whether or not the economy was going to face a hard landing or a soft landing. Now, the data we've been getting in more recently has opened up a new possible scenario, a no landing scenario, in which growth remains above trend while inflation comes back to target. We talked about that this month in the monthly letter, and we're going to get in a bit more detail on that in today's live stream. And I'm really happy to be joined by a few guests to talk it through. We've got Ulrika Hoffmann-Bacardi, who's our Global Head of Equities. We have Jason Dreho, our Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas, and Fred Mellers, who is our Head of Fixed Income. And in the next 25 or 30 minutes, we'll be discussing our outlook for the months ahead. Jason, let's make a start with you. As I said, recent US data has been pretty strong and shifted that narrative towards this no landing scenario. Could you get into a bit more details about what that might look like and how it might affect what the Fed does next?
Well, thank you, Kiran. So these terms, soft landing, no landing, they're not necessarily kind of well-defined, at least there's not generally accepted, you know, what exactly that entails. It's a little bit subjective. I think it helps just put some numbers around what these different scenarios could entail. So starting with a soft landing, I think what most investors have in mind is that the economy return ultimately to go around some sort of measure of long-term trend of about 2% in the US, and then inflation will go back to 2%. So combined, you have growth and inflation together around 4%. So the question is, where are we now? Like, what is the US economy performing at? And on both measures, it's above that. And the one that's probably most surprising is growth. Given the latest data we've gotten on retail sales, on the labor market, even revisions to, you know, measures of income and savings, you know, all of it suggests the economy that's growing, you know, relatively robustly. The data that we have that sort of track estimates for GDP growth in the third quarter is around 3%. That's what it's on track to grow at. It grew at 3% in the first quarter or the second quarter. And for the full year, it's something looking like it's going to grow around 2.5% or a little bit higher. So definitely above that 2% threshold. Inflation is coming down. It's still above the 2% level. Depends exactly what measure you want to look at, but like I say, it's around 2 to 2.5%. So kind of when you add it up, it's more like growth and inflation combined are at, you know, 5%. Now you could say this is kind of no landing, or you could argue, and I think there's a case to be made, that maybe the economy has landed and this 5% combination is where the economy, you know, will stay. We've kind of landed there. So really the question is kind of where do we go forward? In the very near term, like the rest of this quarter, the fourth quarter, into early next year, the US economy has good momentum. So it's not clear like what's going to cause a significant slowdown in growth, at least in the next 3 to 6 months. Inflation should gradually moderate. But I think the level we're at are kind of, you know, at this point in time, they're not going to change very much. Now, next year, it's likely you're going to see some moderation in both growth and inflation. But this is kind of the key question that we're asking. I think investors are now asking, and also for the Fed, like what are they kind of, how do they, you know, respond to all this information? Compared to a month ago, when they cut interest rates 50 basis points, the economy looks stronger than it did. And so it certainly kind of calls into question how much they might cut. We still expect they're going to do 225 basic point cuts this year for 50 total, another 100 next year. Market pricing right now is more like about 75 basis points or 80 basis points for this year. So less than, 40 basis points for the rest of this year. So less. And if the economy comes in strong, then, you know, the data keeps coming in strong, they will do less. It is important to note that Fed officials, multiple Fed officials yesterday were out saying, we still believe the right path is kind of a gradual kind of rate cuts. So the overall story for the US economy is kind of good strength, good momentum, a Fed that still is inclined to cut rates, but they may actually do less given the resilience, given this potentially no landing scenario persisting.
Thanks, Jason. So 5% nominal GDP growth, maybe more rate cuts to come. We'll get into a bit more about what that means for equities in just a moment. But while we've got you here, of course, we do have the US election coming up in just a few weeks. Could you give us a quick update on where we stand and any key considerations for investors as we head into these final weeks of the race?
Well, if you think about what's happened over the past month, polling data has kind of narrowed even more. It was already very tight, but it looks like it's basically a dead heat at this point in time. That's true in national polls, but also in the handful of key swing states that will ultimately determine the outcome for the presidency. What's interesting, though, is if you look at prediction markets where individuals can go and make sort of wagers of, you know, what is the likely outcome, the probability of former President Trump winning and also a red sweep where the Republicans also get control of Congress, that has actually gone up, you know, a decent amount just in the past 2 or 3 weeks. So it's suggesting that the investing community is kind of believing there's a greater chance of Trump winning, getting the Republican red sweep. And that's also reflected in some of the market pricing. So maybe the cleanest way to look at it is if there's kind of baskets of stocks that would be perceived as sort of Trump beneficiaries, that's done well versus a basket of stocks that would be perceived as sort of Harris beneficiaries. So that's an indication the market's shifting in that direction. We've seen a rise in interest rates just in the past few weeks that looks consistent with a red sweep outcome, but it's also true that the economic data, as we've alluded to, is already kind of coming better. That could just reflect better economic data. So the markets have moved in a way maybe more aggressively than to pricing a Trump and red sweep kind of outcome than the polling would indicate. So there is, I think, a little bit of a scope for some surprise if Harris were to actually win in 2 weeks. All this said, when we kind of the guidance that we give to our clients and investors is that it's best not to make significant portfolio changes based on expectations for the election outcome. There are many factors that are driving the markets. Growth, inflation, I think the Fed and the U.S. certainly are probably more important fundamental factors. Also, the makeup of Congress matters a great deal in terms of what fiscal policies could be passed. I think it's going to be very close, and there's probably greater budgetary constraints on the government today than there was 4 years ago and 8 years ago. So it is something to kind of monitor, consider. You're looking at maybe some things to hedge in your portfolio, like gold, that's an asset class we like, as a way to manage sort of political and geopolitical risk. But by and large, we don't think it's advisable to make significant portfolio allocation changes just based on your expectations for the election outcome or even aftermath once there's some sort of clarity. I think that's just, there's other factors that are likely to drive the markets even more.
Okay, thanks, Jason. So yeah, market's starting to price in a Trump victory potentially, but we're not advising large shifts based on this. And we think it's better to be focused on the growth data, inflation data, and the Fed. So let's come back to that and turn to you, Ulrika. We've seen that stronger data coming in, perhaps indicating this no landing scenario. What do you think that means for equity markets broadly?
Yeah, thank you very much, Kieran, and delighted to join this live stream from here from New York City. Let me answer this question with the help of our newly released global equity framework. So in this framework, we look at the market from three perspectives: macro, that you just referenced, structural, big innovation trends, and also the bottom-up perspective. And all three of these views point in one direction, and that is a bullish stance for equities, even though, as you mentioned, there may be some volatility ahead with the US election and also geopolitics. Let me quickly run through the three perspectives. So on the macro side, we do believe the rate cuts do solidify the soft landing that you just referenced. Rate cuts on average are bullish for global stock markets, and especially so when the market is close to all-time highs. In fact, it's only happened three times since the Fed started pivoting towards targeting interest rates in the 80s. And these times all happened in the mid-80s under Volcker. And the market, on average, has been up over 20% when the rate cuts were more than 50 basis points and the market was within 1% of its all-time high. Secondly, if we look at the market through a structural lens, so the big transformational innovation opportunities, we think AI will continue to be a driver of stock market returns. In fact, a recent survey showed that AI spending intentions continue to go up and actually are even slightly accelerating, and now also stretching across more and more industries. And then lastly, from a bottom-up perspective, we see further upside in large-cap technology companies, where we expect strong and growing free cash flow generation into 2025. You may ask, how can tech companies fund all of this CapEx and still show so much free cash flow generation? Well, one interesting stat is to compare the debt of GDP of the US government to the debt of revenue for US large cap technology companies. And we actually find that the government is twice as indebted as that collection of US large cap technology companies. So to summarize, all our three perspectives in our global equity framework point to more upside: the macro, the structural perspective, and also the bottom-up fundamentals. But we do recognize that the next few weeks will be volatile.
Great, thank you, Ulrika. And we'll be staying with you to get into a bit more detail on some of the sectors to focus on. Great, so Ulrika, coming back to you, let's dive into some of the details about what you've just said. So you've painted quite a bullish picture there with the positive macro, structural and micro drivers. Which are some of the specific sectors that you think look most interesting here?
Yeah, leaving the election aside for a moment, we do like technology, utilities, and financials. Again, if we go through the three perspectives from a macro lens, lower rates benefit growth stocks, such as technology companies, but they also favor the rate-sensitive utilities, which now have relatively more attractive dividend yields compared to fixed income. On the structural side, all three sectors are also beneficiaries of AI. So the technology sector as an enabler of AI, the utility sector as the power producer for AI data centers, and then lastly, financials as companies that can lever AI to drive more productivity. And then lastly, we see from a bottom-up side, more upside in large cap tech, but also the unregulated utilities and large cap banks. And at the same time, this collection of sectors is also a diversified basket that can take us through the volatility of the election.
Great, thank you. Thank you, Ulrika. And you mentioned the election there, and I saw a slide a moment ago just looking at some of the potential impacts. Do you want to spend a few words on perhaps how the election might impact some of those specific equity sectors? Jason touched a bit on the potential outcomes.
Yeah, certainly there are going to be sector implications of the US election, and each of the three sectors that I mentioned, in particular financials, will likely outperform under a Trump victory of any kind, whereas, you know, technology probably will likely to be more muted. So again, we think having a diversified set of sector exposures into the election is the right way to position for it. I would also say that more broadly, the volatility that may come from more position squaring, more uncertainty, as Jason has pointed out, you know, the election is getting tighter and tighter, may offer opportunities to add at lower levels. So we think the election itself, but also geopolitical uncertainty, potentially more export restrictions to come right after the elections, are also great entry points to set up for a more bullish position into year end. We know on the macro side, the rate cuts, also the stimulus from China, AI, and then the power of these large cap compounders will likely drive equities into new highs in year end. Also, would just like to point out, if you'd like to learn more about our global equity views, more of a deep dive, and also our new framework, please feel free to reach out to your advisors who can share copies of both of these reports. With that, I'll hand it over back to you, Kieran.
Great. Thanks, Ulrika. Yeah, definitely a must read new publication there to get into more details on that. And, you know, I think quite a compelling outlook for markets, even if there is a bit of volatility around the election in the near term. We're going to turn our attention now just to fixed income and Fred. No landing for the economy, US election, deficits, you know, what does all this mean for fixed income, and how should investors be thinking about how they manage their portfolios?
Yeah, hi, Kieran. Thanks for the question. Thanks for having me on. So look, when thinking about the various macro scenarios, the no landing scenario, look, the key risk for fixed income as an asset class is and always has been inflation. You know, this is what basically destroys fixed income returns. This is what we saw in 2022 when inflation obviously surged to multi-decade highs and central banks had to respond by raising rates aggressively. So there's obviously some scarring that's been left from that episode in 2022. And as has just been discussed, now with US elections just around the corner and some of the policies that have been discussed around tariffs, taxes, migration, there's some concern creeping into the bond market that the inflation genie is about to come out of the bottle again. And mixed in with that, we have issues in the Middle East. Oil prices are incredibly volatile. And then fiscal situations in countries like the US, here in Europe, around deficit and debts is the elephant in the room. So look, there's clearly some inflationary risks still lingering. But having said all of that, you know, today we're in a much different backdrop to 2022. First and foremost, as you can see in front of you, interest rates are much higher across all the different fixed income segments. The level of outright interest rates across all these different segments is your friend here in an uncertain environment. Obviously, with interest rates much higher than what they were in 2021, that provides a significant buffer to ongoing mark-to-market volatility. Policy is restrictive. Central banks have taken policy rates into restrictive territory, and now they're starting to ease gradually and remove that level of restriction. So that does provide a little bit of a tailwind to returns. So basically, we think that going forward, the current level of rates across these different fixed income segments are probably your best guide to forward returns. So when you look at the chart on the right here, what we have shaded in red is basically if you were to buy a five-year high-grade bond today, you can basically lock in a yield of 4%. That is implying a Fed rate cutting cycle of around 150 basis points. So if the Fed delivers on today's current market expectations, you'll generate annualized 4% returns for the next 5 years without a lot of risk. Okay, not as sexy as what you may be able to get on AI stocks, but still a pretty solid return with not a lot of volatility around it. Now, of course, if the Fed starts to cut more aggressively, if you move to the right of that red column, you can see that the returns start to amplify pretty quickly. So this is if we start to move into a little bit more of a hard landing scenario. So here we think, you know, the asset class provides you a pretty good buffer or a shock absorber to any potential uncertainty in the equity market. So having a diversified portfolio, as we always say, we think is a must. The risk, of course, is if you move to the left of that red bar and the Fed actually thinks, look, hang on, we have to pause the rate cutting cycle. We're only going to cut 100 or 50. Even there, you can still make a little bit of money. But if they have to resume the rate hiking cycle, this is where returns start to become a little bit of a problem. But of course, you can see there's still some good asymmetry here between the Fed surprising us with more cuts versus them surprising us with having to cut by less or actually having to restart the rate hiking cycle.
Great. Thanks, Fred. And so we talked equities, fixed income. Commodities have been in the headlines as well. Gold hitting another record high today. What are your recommendations in the commodity space for investors?
Yeah, sure. The short story is, look, we like commodities as an asset class. Of course, within the asset class, there's obviously a number of different subsegments and nuances with their own unique drivers. You mentioned gold, as you can see on the left here. Gold is hitting all-time highs. You know, we're still constructive, even at these levels, that there's more upside to be made on gold. Typically, when central banks do start to ease policy, you start to see real rates come down. So the opportunity cost of holding gold diminishes. That's the environment we're in at the moment with rate cuts coming across the board. But structurally, we think things have changed in the gold market. Since 2022, when Russia's FX reserves were basically seized or frozen by the West, that has obviously precipitated a rethink of central bank FX reserves across the globe. And as a consequence, central banks have been significant buyers of gold, which has been a huge driver of prices over the last 2 years. That is not changing. Central banks, from what we understand, are going to continue to increase their gold holdings within their FX reserve positions and deallocate out of fiat money. So this is why we think there's still some upside. In other commodity complexes such as energy, as you can see on the right, and I touched on a little bit the issues in the Middle East at the moment, volatility is very elevated, as you can see. But if you strip away the uncertainty and the geopolitical concerns, the supply-demand backdrop, in our humble opinion, still is favorable for more upside on oil. Brent has been trading around $70 to $80 a barrel. We think it can get over 80. We have an OPEC Plus meeting coming up at the beginning of November, where we'll learn more about whether they want to maintain these production cuts. There's also been some weather disruptions in North America impacting production. So we do think there's upside to be had on oil. The other sort of key commodity complex is industrial metals. Ulrich here touched on this earlier. You know, China is now providing stimulus and support. So we think that the downside risks on China growth, particularly emanating out of their property sector, are starting to dissipate as policymakers wake up to the need to having to provide more support. So although we think industrial metal prices are fair as of today, you know, once we get more clarity on some of the measures that China wants to do on the fiscal side, we think industrial metals are an interesting place to look as well.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you, Fred. We're now getting into questions. We've got lots coming in. I'm going to try and categorize a few of those just to get through as many as we can. So quite a few questions coming in on the U.S. deficit. I think in short, what is the impact of the election on the deficit? Do we need to worry about it? And maybe a particular touch on the U.S. dollar. What might it mean for the dollar? And Jason, I'll hand that one to you.
Well, let's first put in context how large is the deficit. It's around 6.5% of GDP, give or take a few tenths of a percent. I mean, when it's that large, I'm not sure it makes that much difference. The projections are, for the time being, it's going to stay at over 6% based on the Congressional Budget Office forecasts. We know pretty certain it's not going to change much over the next 12 months because we're not going to get probably any significant policy changes, you know, spending plans, tax cuts until 2026, regardless of the election outcome. And that's because the central debate in Washington, D.C. next year from a policy perspective will be what to do with the tax cuts, the personal tax cuts that were first implemented back in 2018 under President Trump. All the personal tax cuts are set to expire. So the question is how much of those will be extended. The CBO assumes, and their projections assume as far as the deficit goes, that they will all expire. If they were all extended, that will add upwards of $5 trillion in total to the debt over the course of a decade. So when we think about kind of policy, and this kind of goes back to some comments earlier about, you know, the election impact on the macro outlook, is that it's unlikely we're going to get significant fiscal expansion given the large deficits, and just keeping, you know, the existing tax cuts in place will be further expansionary to the deficits. So I think the election outcome doesn't necessarily change that story. It's possible the deficit could get larger, but it's already at over a 6% level. And that, again, doesn't look like it's going to change very much. And I can tell you in the U.S., there's been very little focus on as part of the election about deficit reduction, debt reduction. That's not been a popular topic. It's not politically kind of relevant right now. Until it is, I think your politicians don't want to make sort of the political challenges or deal with that until it happens, which actually does have implications for, you know, other considerations, including Fed policy. And I go back a little bit to the discussion about, you know, the economy, the no landing situation, and Fred alluded to this also for inflation regarding the kind of bond outlook. If you are sitting at the Federal Reserve and you see deficits that are 6.5%, you know, it does sort of bias you all equal to maybe letting the economy run a little bit hot, letting growth stay above 2%, maybe inflation above 2% to run closer to that 5%. The closer the economy is growing to the deficit, the more the deficit situation, the debt situation, at least stays stable until there's a political solution. So I think the risk is that inflation, you know, given the policy situation, kind of continues to run on the hot side of 2%. How much hotter, that's debatable.
Great, thanks. Thanks, Jason. We'll get Dominic on perhaps in another week to get onto the currency situation. But I you know, certainly know we have a negative stance on the US dollar, partly related to that deficit and preferring other currencies like the Swiss franc, where you've got obviously a more stable debt situation and lower inflation. We've got some questions coming in on equities as well, so I'll turn to you on those. So first up, China, what are our views on Chinese equities? Obviously a big rally in anticipation of some stimulus. What do we think comes next? And then we've got a question on dividends. But why don't we just start with China first?
Yeah, so maybe before going into China, I also just wanted to make a comment on the US budget deficit. So from an equity perspective, we are also concerned about the current debt levels. We think there is a risk that term premium can go up, which is clearly a negative for equities. On the other side, I want to just mention that there is one remedy that the US has to get out of the current debt situation, and that is artificial intelligence. So if indeed we will be able to, in the US, compound 2 to 5% productivity gains annually, that would be one way to offset the debt payments and the debt load. So just through expansion of GDP. So now to your question on China, we do believe that China is committed to a turn in the economy. I think the timing of a lot of the announcements are likely somewhat aligned with the election from a game theoretic perspective. You probably don't want to have too much stimulus announced prior to what is going to be a very important election for China. So our view is that the election really is the biggest roadblock to become more positive on China. A Trump election victory would certainly be a negative for the equity markets. You play back to what happened to China equities when tariffs were imposed under the first Trump administration. We have a pretty good idea that there is double-digit downside ahead during that period. So for us, we are constructive on China, in particular, China internet companies, because there we think they benefit from the structural tailwinds that we talked about, AI in particular, but also further operating leverage, because those large cap tech companies have shown very good operational efficiency improvement over the last quarters. So overall constructive on China large cap tech, in particular internet companies that have an AI tailwind, but we want to wait for the election outcome before deciding on our next steps.
Great, thanks, Ulrika. We've just got two minutes left, so we'll address one of the questions coming in around dividends. So interest rates coming down, investors looking for income, perhaps the more conservative equity investors, you know, what would you recommend for them if they're looking for returns and income in the next years?
Yeah, we like utilities. And we like utilities, again, from all our three investment perspectives in equities. We like it from a macro perspective, because now with rates coming down, those dividend yields between 3 and 5% look relatively more attractive now than they used to 12 months ago. Also offers more diversification should we see more macro risk factors around geopolitics and the factors of the US election. Secondly, we like it because of the structural positioning towards AI. So one of the things that we have highlighted in our equity calls in the last few weeks is the demand for power will significantly tick up over the next few years, just because AI is incredibly power hungry, and each new generation of a large language model does need exponentially more compute. So utilities are well positioned because they have to now spend on CapEx to deliver on that need for more power. And utilities, especially in the US, make profits based on their CapEx that's deployed. So we like the structural positioning. And then lastly, we like especially the unregulated utilities, because they're the ones that can most easily partake in that upside from more and more power demand. So it's one of those sectors that has exposure to all of these three dimensions. And we think it's a good long-term diversifier for any portfolio, but also long-term investment opportunity.
Great. Thanks, Ulrika. So yeah, opportunities in utilities, tech, fixed income, investment grade, gold, maybe some volatility around the election, but AI might even pay for the deficit. So good news all around. Thank you, everybody, for joining, and I hope you can join us again soon. Thank you and have a good day.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.